Welcome to Polycast, the civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mian Team.
Mad Jin.
With guest co-hosts.
Jack Soldier.
Jonah Falcon.
The live stream is on. People are just listening to this go.
Yeah.
Edit it all later and make it sound professional. Well, professional-ish.
Welcome everyone to episode 259. Makalua.
Who needs more caffeine since I couldn't have it for almost a week? Rah!
The me and team.
I have all kinds of new things to show you.
New or nude?
N-E-W, Mackie. Both? Calm down.
Good thing this isn't a video conference.
Yep.
Jin?
Taking bets on how long it'll take Dan to interject.
And guest host, Canuck Soldier myself. Hello, everyone. I'm glad to be back. And Jonah Falcon.
Hi, I went to E3 and it was completely pointless.
Pulling from the chat, Pleasant's asking, given how the uniques are distributed for Civ 6, do you think we might see Civs get alternate leaders in one of the DLCs, or do we expect they're just extra Civs and max packs? I think the general answer to that is we don't know yet. There's a lot of speculation on the forum for and against the idea of extra Civs versus extra leaders or alt leaders. It sort of feels like there's potential for alt leaders because they're splitting out leader from the Civ when it comes to uniques. Or at least for America, they made it really, really obvious that they were separate. But people are kind of for and against the idea because they can just create new Civs for slightly more cost than just putting in alt leaders. Although they'd have to actually put the infrastructure in for alt leaders. So that would also cost that too.
Well, if Civ 5 DLC is any thing to go by, I would say we'll probably see that in DLC, but it is a money-making company. I mean, I'm sure the financial success of Civ 5 and Beyond Earth certainly drove the development of Civ 6 in 2K's eyes.
The new civilization announced with England, we get Victoria instead of Elizabeth this time. Some people are a little not happy that, why is it another female leader again? Thinking about it, for people outside of the UK or in the Commonwealth who maybe don't know as much history, that Victoria and Elizabeth are probably two more recognizable ones, along with maybe like Henry VIII. That's like the first three that pop into my head.
It's a four tossed in Churchill too.
Yeah, and Churchill. Yeah, but when talking about, yeah, but they're iconic leaders regardless, you know, and it's just England has a bigger share of iconic female leaders, so we're more likely to get that with England.
Probably a little too early for Margaret Thatcher, but maybe.
No.
I'm also thinking Queen Anne and Lizzie II and a number of other ones.
You know, on the balance of it, yeah, that's a good leader choice.
I think she was basically responsible for the, the sun never sets on the British Empire.
What'd you win?
We win the British Museum, which grants more archaeologists, and we have more slots to put those shiny artifacts in. They've got both the sea dogs, which, guess what? The sea dogs get to bully and capture enemy vessels. So now Dan has something to bully. And also the redcoats, who can actually jump off the boats and start attacking things right away. They've got the amphibious thing from the start. Combat bonus on other continents.
It depends on what the game's considering a continent. Because if you're going by Civ 4 and 5 rules, mainland Europe would be considered a different continent from England.
Actually, that's in most games, which is really annoying.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's just easier computationally to just go, okay, well, that's a separate landmass from this landmass, so it's a different continent, even if it's one hex.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen a game count hex squares to determine islands versus continents.
I'm wondering if they're using Red Coast simply for the time period. Like, it's sort of a play balancing thing. They said, well, we can't have ancient and we can't have futuristic. So we'll have England have their special unit sometime during the middle.
Well, it's somewhere about the leader-ish time. The way they were talking about the civs as they were going through the leader-based more around their actual time. And sometimes the units pull from that versus the civ level is kind of across time.
America wants to kind of stay on its continent and keep everybody off of its continent. And England's like, no, we're coming onto your continents, all your continents. All your continents are belong to England.
Yeah.
So their agendas.
Kind of clashy.
Yeah. Somewhat clashy, including the bonuses.
So, as long as you get it rocking before the industrial age, those redcoats are pretty good.
I guess redcoats would probably come with guns, though, somewhere in there.
Yeah.
I'd imagine rifling, maybe.
Yeah, something like that.
That's what it was in Civ 4, and they really should require rifling, because when they became more iconic like that was in the time of rifled barrels, not muskets.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm sure they'll make us wait until navigation for the Royal Navy Dockyard, because they're not going to let us build a bunch of triremes and make them all super upgraded.
Yeah.
It's the unique district, though.
Yeah.
So it would probably just replace the harbor.
Besides, it'd be nice to have, like, usable triremes.
Usable boats before navigation. That would be nice. Yeah. You know, there were new usable boats before navigation. The other bonuses with the dockyard is you get bonus gold and on other continents and bonus great admiral points. Makes sense. English Navy was well known. You can get more admirals.
And more money from their places.
Yes. From all that trade you're doing, since the sun never sets on it.
Mm-hmm. And then you go bully people to capture their fleets.
And
all your ship art belongs to us.
And all your continents.
Although I do have to throw a bone out there. I hate that they named it England. I really do.
Oh, instead of Britain considering it's Victoria?
Yeah, or the UK. I mean, people don't like UK because that's not a civ, but British is more the civ than England. Because England didn't exist.
I would say Great Britain probably would be okay historically.
Yeah.
Not the UK.
Yeah, I mean, the UK you could kind of go, eh, but Great Britain or Britain, British or Britain, anything in there that's not England.
Yeah, it's not the English Empire, it's the British Empire.
Yep. As labeled, it was British.
Mm-hmm.
That's true.
Even the civability says British.
Yeah, so it's like, guys.
And also, if you looked at the blog post that went with the video, the very first line is like, oh, here's the English. So the leader of the United Kingdom. very first line just kind of dropped using the word English.
The English can be an aggressive and expansionist civilization, but they can also switch towards a cultural victory if they set up their museums and send their archaeologists abroad.
I want to talk about Egypt next.
Yeah, speaking about not fixing something.
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
Here we have another leader that's being questioned a bit. Probably a bit more fairly than Vicky, to be honest. I would have preferred to see Hattie back than Cleopatra, but that's fine.
There's a little bit of controversy in Cleopatra, since she sort of ruled over the demise of Egypt, but she is well known.
Yeah, well.
And at least this time she looks more like a woman than, say, Civ Rev.
Instead of an anime Egyptian character?
Or that one.
She likes powerful militaries, so if you have a lot of units, she will be attracted to your units. That's how it goes.
Yeah.
So there's one thing about I find interesting. I don't want to step on your toes, but when they say only they can build monuments on floodplains, does that mean no one else can?
Well, that's the thing. And some people kind of picked up on that when they saw it. I mean, it really does sound like no one else can do that.
Yeah.
The Egyptian civ's special ability is called Iteru. It allows Egypt to build districts and wonders faster if they're located on rivers.
If they're going to call it out in a civ ability that they can do it, that does make you think that no one else can.
It implies exclusivity for sure.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I wonder if it's that they get to retain the floodplain's benefits and not lose it if they build a district or a monument over it. It could be that too. You know,
that's the thing. Then in one of the videos, it showed that I think you actually lose the tile yields when you put a district down, because whenever they do highlights over holy sites or stuff like that, it doesn't have the base tile yield underneath it. They've got screenshots of that. So I don't think that's an argument for it, that they would be able to keep it per se.
So it's just whether they can do it at all versus other civs.
Yeah. Everybody else would farm it or just do improvements on them. And she could actually build districts. Granted, everybody else would probably just throw their districts in the middle of the crappy desert anyways. It's like, this tile sucks. Put a district there.
Well, if Egypt turns out not to be good, it would be one of the first times ever in a Civ game, so that would surprise me.
Hmm.
Or searchers look pretty good.
Yeah, the Marianu chariot archers. They get a real name this time.
Other than just being Egyptian chariot archers, yeah.
Yeah.
Good to see chariot archers back. Four movement, 23 melee strength, 33 range strength, attack range 2, Egyptian UU. So yeah, basic stats for it. I wonder if chariots will still have the same problem with movement in harsh terrain.
They get an extra movement if they start on flat land.
Yeah, which will make them really devastating in flat land, probably. Especially if conquest in the early game is actually worth something this go around.
Yep. So lots of high speed running around, shooting everything.
It's hard to tell. We haven't heard anything about spears or anything. Any unit with anti-horse or anti-range abilities, but I'm sure there's going to be something in the early game for that.
There has to be something to offset range. XO5's range dominance is stupid. They really need something to offset that. And when I see a unit like this, I think scoot and shoot. And what stops them from doing that? I mean, okay, you might need to end your turn after attacking or something, unless you have a promotion. But even with that, when you have this kind of mobility and other units more in the neighborhood of 2, they're really hard to deal with or to kill, especially in the open, if they're handled competently. It becomes a problem. They're just too much better than other units at that stage.
Yeah, that's fine, because that's exactly when they stop being useful, is after that space.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I wasn't talking just the Egyptian chariots. I meant, like, all chariots are ridiculous at first because of the movement like that. Although you wouldn't really notice on high difficulties in single player, but...
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, especially until you get iron and have a better unit to counter them, which by then you're probably dead in the water.
Yeah, what makes you think you'll be able to hook that up?
Yeah.
This is an intriguing unit, but a lot of the baseline mechanics of the game will affect how strong they are and my opinion of them in general.
Yeah, we still don't know what the rock, paper, scissor attempt is this time.
Yeah.
Or how things interact with each other. Or the generalized combat strength of... Well, everything.
And you get some context looking at the units here. Swordsman's like melee strength 35, horseman melee strength 32, the chariot archer's melee strength 23, and they're obviously weaker, and you would expect that. But how much damage does that do per turn, you know? Does that mean that if you hit one of them with 2 units flanking it, will you be able to kill it, or do you need 3? You know, that kind of detail is just something I haven't seen yet.
Yeah, that overall balance kind of thing we won't see for a while.
But apparently they're stronger hand-to-hand than warriors.
Their leader ability, so what Cleo gets, is plus gold to trade routes that you start, and extra gold trade routes others have with you and the originator. Basically, she likes trade routes, and she cannot lie. She'll give a load of food to other people who send her a trade route.
Sounds like a nice AI to put in your pocket with the trade routes, and then you beat on somebody, and then she doesn't like them because they have a weak military, and then, yeah. She likes you for beating on someone she doesn't like because you beat on them.
That is so dirty.
And then, of course, her unique tile improvement, the Sphinx, gives culture and faith, and then you get more culture and faith if you build it next to a wonder.
Sounds like a good way of keeping your cities happy and large.
Yeah, or making sure you get a religion or being able to spread it or whatever that is.
Is that happiness thing going to compound when it's next to multiple wonders?
We don't know yet.
That would be interesting. Yeah. It might be kind of difficult to shove multiple wonders into a city and then get the Sphinxes lined.
Well, you might get a couple of around. You know, I'm not telling you like trying to completely surround a Sphinx, but if you had like 2 or maybe 3 adjacent to it, you know, you had a wonders district out there in the crap desert.
Yeah,
you know,
could be.
To allocate district for wonders. You just can't go pig wild on wonders anymore. You can't have a city with 500 wonders in it anymore, because otherwise they won't have any way to generate any sort of production.
Or for food, really.
Yeah, you can starve yourself doing that.
You could trade route the hell out of it, but still.
Yeah, we don't know how the trade routes work this time.
There you go. You just trade route all this stuff into a wonder city and then let it starve with its, like, 10 wonders. Just sit there.
And then somebody comes along and eats all your trade routes.
Well, no, once you finish the wonders, you just stop trading with that city and let it starve into garbage. You just have all these wonders sitting around.
I'd almost hope that they would actually make you work the wonder to get the bonus.
You'd have to upscale the wonder's bonus strength then. Otherwise, the incentive to bother constructing it at all just wouldn't exist.
Yeah, it would depend on how good they are.
The Egyptians are a wonder-focused civ, and especially powerful in the early game when they start near a river. They're also uniquely valuable partners to other civs, So rather than isolating themselves, the Egyptians remain central to the political landscape throughout the game.
Okay, so next on our list of first looks is Japan, because 2K Japan decided to just throw that out there.
It.
2 in 1 week. Everybody basically knew Hojo was going to be the boss. Hojo Tokimune, so from the mid-Civ level, Middle Ages-ish. His agenda, though, is Bushido. Go figure. They like using that word. He likes civilizations with a strong military, but only if they also produce faith and culture. So, again, another one who also likes strong militaries, but he's got an addendum to that. They also have to produce faith and culture. So he could have a neighbor with a huge military, but if they're way low on faith and culture, he won't like them. It's more of a build your empire properly sort of agenda.
Screw that. Nobody built their empire properly. I'll build my empire on Japan.
So
I wonder how long it'll take for people to call the quote-unquote Triforce on his...
first thing I thought of when I looked at it, I was like, why is he wearing a Triforce?
People called it out a long time ago as soon as they saw the picture. It's just the problem is that it's actually his set.
So now we know what Link grows up to be.
Yeah, or rather where Nintendo got some of its source material, perhaps, but, you know.
Yeah, that was it. The Triforce came after. Anyways, the Civ ability is the Meiji Restoration. So later in the Civ's life era, bonuses to district adjacency. And in the video when they were talking about it, basically a normal district side by side with another district, you get a +1 bonus for every 2 adjacent districts. And it looks like Japan gets an extra 1 per extra district. So you could take your city center, drop down 2 districts right beside it, and then all of them would get extra bonuses on top of whatever they would normally get from terrain and stuff. So that makes them very, very, very flexible, I think. I don't think you still want to blatantly ignore train-related adjacencies. Depends on what you get. Like, the Holy Site gets big adjacency bonus for being next to a natural wonder. So you wouldn't want to ignore the natural wonder just to slot it in next to another district for that. But you'd probably want a Holy Site next to the natural wonder and then slap up another district beside it rather than the other way around. It also means if you have, say, a mountain chain, put a campus next to 2 mountains, put the Holy Site right next to it, next to 2 other mountains, and then they get extra boost just for being next to each other, whereas Civs would require another district on top of that.
Didn't the video say that the Japanese would prefer to have a more smaller, compact civilization?
Well, yeah, I mean, it would be for this district adjacency part. So the more compact it is, the more these districts boost each other. If you had 6 districts next to each other, a lot of them would get pretty high bonuses just for being there. The more compact you build, the better bonuses you get. Again, you probably don't want to completely ignore terrain bonuses, especially if there's like a super spot. But it does sort of mean if they roll a really crappy start where, say, you don't have mountains near you or there's no natural wonders near you, then you could still slap down your districts and get something out of it by putting them together, whereas everybody else would seemingly get a lot less.
And then you have the samurai.
Yeah, and then you have a samurai. So it doesn't lose combat strength when wounded, which was basically the overall Civ 5 bonus. So at the very least, only the unit gets it this time, rather than it being the whole thing. And the video mentioned that it does not replace a unit, which means it's a separate unit.
So you just look at Japanese sword and samurais.
Yeah, at the same time. And it comes at military tactics. That's actually kind of nice, because that leads to other uniques potentially also not destroying the base unit. Like, you know, in Civ 5, all those Kesheks and camel archers that showed up at that melee unit.
Take the city. Sorry. No Kesheks can take cities.
Yep.
Troll-a-lol.
Troll-a-lol. So possibly, if Kesheks are in and the Mongols are in, that means if they have Kesheks, then they'd be able to build Kesheks and knights. And then
Mongols
they'd have
to be in. I will disapprove if the Mongols are not in.
Also means Mutters could make new units and slap them in wherever makes sense rather than always at the same one. Otherwise, their unique building is the electronics factory. It replaces the factory and gives out bonus production as well as culture to all nearby cities.
Gotta buy that boombox.
So in that sense, that part sounds like you want slightly compacter cities, or at least not super spread out. It's a question of all nearby cities depends on what does nearby mean. Is there a specific hex count?
Yeah, exactly.
What's the hex count? And already people on the forum are all like, whoo, I'll just build crap ton of cities right next to each other, and then we'll slap in all these electronic factories right next to each other, and then we'll have massive bonus production.
So they're going to try and build their Civ like real life Japan with a bunch of cities all crammed in next to each other.
Yeah, my only problem with that thought line is that if you've got a bunch of cities all smashed together, how many hexes are they all going to get if they're all that close?
Yeah.
Yeah, it depends on the per city penalties and how local happiness is interacting with it.
Well, no, just ignoring that. Just pretend those don't exist.
How big can your cities be if you're
you can line up with viable sprawl is my point. Or even quote-unquote file sharing, if that's still a thing in Civ 6.
Yeah, but I would assume you're not going to tile share a district, since districts
are... Are you sure?
Well, it says districts are based on your population of your city. So if you could tile share it, you could have one city build a district, have another city pick it up, and then have that original city build another district?
I guess you would only be able to pick it up with the second city if you were otherwise capable of making a district in it, if they did it that way. I have no idea how that's going to work in practice. I'm just saying, depending on the mechanics and how the growth incentives are, that may be more or less viable.
Well, yeah, it just depends. Because if it's also giving production and culture to nearby cities, why would you need to tile share it?
Yeah, that's true.
Anything else on Japan? Oh, right, Divine Wind. Land units get a combat bonus when fighting near the coast, and naval units get a combat bonus when fighting on shallow waters. Basically, hope for a hurricane to wipe out the Mongols.
That's a pretty big boost to a navy bombarding coastal cities and units.
Yeah, and also if England shows up with their silly redcoats, then you'd get a bonus against that.
Or you could attack them in England where they don't get their bonus and you get a bonus because you're near coast. Ha ha.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Japan, at least some of the speculation on the forum, they fit the whole Japan's on an island thing and therefore would fit better on that.
Yeah, but what if they're in the middle of a landlocked continent?
Well, their agenda would still work. The Meiji registration for bonus districts would still work. The samurai would still work. The electronics factory would still work. So really, something that seems like the smallest of the things would be the only thing that wouldn't work. Whoop-de-doo. I mean, if you think about the British, start them in the center of a Pangaea, no sea dogs, no dockyards, and potentially no redcoats getting bonuses, far worse than Japan not getting a small combat bonus.
Builders is next.
Yeah, I guess we're on to builders now.
As I already know, there are no workers in Civilization VI. Instead, you build builders. They build improvements, and they have 3 charges each, which is nice because one thing I always hated in previous Civs was that you inevitably had too many workers, and you just have to start killing them off when you didn't need them anymore. For roads, well, you don't build those. Actually, the trade caravans do it for you. So once you start trading, they find their own ways, and it turns into roads. Later on, you have military engineers.
This is what we get for complaining about that part where we are sitting with, I have a bunch of works, I don't have things to do with them. Well, now you have to pay for them.
You always paid for them.
But instead of getting one eternal worker unit at 4000 BC or whatever, now you have to build multiple ones over the years.
Yeah, I have mixed feelings. We'll see how it works out.
Yeah.
Too many details about the game's nuances that I can't really make a decent judgment on how this is going to play out. The worker micromanagement was one of the biggest skill differentiators in previous Civs. Even reasonably experienced players underestimated the difference you could make by making your worker decisions intelligently. That said, there's a lot of rote interaction with the game and hassle to it as well, and that becomes even more prevalent as the game goes on. The use you get out of a worker is less relevant to your outcome of the game, and it's just shaving a turn or two, maybe. So we'll see.
In Civilization VI, building improvements may also unlock tech boosts, making them valuable for progress.
Interesting decisions for builders, too. Like, you only get 3 shots, so what do you use them on? How expensive are they if you need them again? It's not without choices, and you do get your improvement built instantly with them.
And I think that's the bigger thing is that now you can waste it a little bit knowing that once he's out there, boom, 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 they're done. You don't have to worry about him anymore. You know, if you... Yeah.
I think that's a mistake. If you have to invest resources into making improvements more consistently, if you're constantly throwing hammers into this, then not just the ordering of improvements you make or which improvements, does that actually outcompete building something else? Or what are your priorities there with using these builders? The way I'm picturing it, if they're doing this decently, it will have as much useful decisions to make as workers, plus a few extra because of the opportunity cost of your build queue. So you can get yourself stuck by making builders and putting it on suboptimal places very easily. That might even be worse than just building a building at this point.
So the later you go in a sieve, though, the less frequently you use a builder. I mean, you'll have them using one thing, and you'll wait around, you know, for something new. I mean, in the early game, farm, 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 the stuff you need right away. Later in the sieve, I don't think you'd need them that much. So you'd have one guy with two charges left, and you're saying, where can I use this guy for? Oh, I'll build this because I really need this for now. I think they'd be stretched out the further later in the game than you would in the beginning of the game when you need those resources right now.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, Phil's already hit on it. It's build order that really takes over instead of micromanaging individual turns for workers. Yeah. If you could just spam workers and build a bunch of improvements, just like that you would in Civ 5, and then eventually the population would catch up. But in this, it's sounding a lot more because of build order and other stuff that you don't want to do that. You may have a lot of empty hexes.
It depends on how costs scale. Because if they do it too far in one direction, you could make it so that you want very few builders. Or they could inadvertently leave us in Civ 3 land where you just spam settlers and builders all the time because that gives you better value than anything else you can build, which would be awful. But well, it could happen if you tune the resources that way.
It also depends on what hex yields are versus buildings versus district.
I feel like roads are an important advantage to a defending Civ, at least in every single Civ iteration so far. I would not like to see that go away either, because mobility is something that the game really needs.
Well, yeah. Especially as you get later in the game, it's like, oh, I got to go across the Pangaea again. It'll take 20 turns to get there.
Yeah, I think without early roads, units with high mobility are really going to make a difference now.
Well, you will have early roads. You just need to have trade with the other cities.
Yeah.
Yeah, but if you're a warmonger and don't care about training, you know,
internal trade runs, though.
Yeah, internal.
Trading. Now, don't you?
Well, if you're a warmonger and trade routes build roads, of course you send a trade route to the enemy's capital first. And then you get a road.
So we get to label those trade units Trojan horses?
Sure, why not? I don't know. I'm not 100% on trade routes building all the roads, because you are really, really, really leaving it to whatever the road defining code is. And that can either be really, really good or the worst possible road building exercise ever.
Sounds great on paper as individual things, but how it all works together, I don't know. It could be a micromanaging mess.
Yeah, you know, maybe.
I mean,
yeah, one of the things that Buzzing brought up in the chat about balancing is it'd be interesting if they didn't have a fixed cost, if it was a change by era or something, you'd have to think about it more, what you were wanting to do.
If they make it to the point where you're actually doing more inputs to create improvements with builders than you did with workers, if it...
Oh, yeah. Like, micromanagement.
It could actually become more of a hassle, because now you have to queue up the builder and then make the builder and then move it on to the spawn and then instruct it to build that. If the game's designed in a way where you have strong incentive to do that over and over and over and over again and not to consider alternatives, that's going to get mundane and tiresome very quickly. So I would say that's the biggest fear with builders.
That could be a possibility, but I think your local warmonger will probably keep doing that.
You would hope.
Oh, yeah.
With one unit per hex, I have strong doubts that your local warmonger could viably prevent that long term.
Depends on your build order, right?
Yeah, but units. Like I said, that's the reason I fear this outcome, is if they don't have good stops for it, then that's going to happen and it's going to be annoying. So hopefully they have that countermeasure either on release or pretty quickly after.
The people are the heroes now. The heroes, the peasants now.
Apparently, people were talking. Dan was replying.
I do not narrate the feature videos. There isn't more women on the internet. Come on, guys.
Yeah, somewhere in there, somebody suggested Mackie was, or Nunor, doing the featurette videos.
Although he has a point. If you tried, you could probably get that voice pretty close if you wanted Mackie.
So I went to E3, and the first thing I did was I went to the Civ 6 booth, or whatever they call it, and I was expecting a presentation. We went into this room, and instead of someone coming out and talking about the mechanics, they just played the 12-minute video with Orson Bean or Sean Bean or whoever. So we left, and I was scribbling notes because, as you saw, it was sort of like a diary, and I was trying to glean the information that they were giving me. They weren't giving direct, you know, districts. No, they talked around about district, right? And Dennis Shirk was there. You know, he was in 2K's thing, so I never got to speak to him or anybody else. So a week later, 2K releases the entire video that I just saw to everybody. And it's like, why was I there? If there was nothing there that you told me that you couldn't have just released as a video at E3. Dan was going to have me on 2 weeks ago and said, well, guess what, Dan? There's nothing I can tell you that you didn't see in that video now. And I said, okay, see you another time. So that's what I mean at E3 for the most part. And this wasn't just Civ 6, but everything else. It was like a big waste of time for me because everything they told everybody else a week later. So I could have just waited at home and watched the video a week later. Yeah. Is what I'm saying.
Yeah, welcome to E3.
So it's like, oh, thanks. At least I got some sweet books and pens. That's all I really got out of it was a Civ 6 pen and a Civ 6 journal.
I went to E3 and all I got was a sweet pen.
Fine, Mars. We're going to call you out. He feels like he has to brace himself every episode for shenanigans. Don't worry. We'll have more. Always shenanigans. He voiced concern about aquatic and naval gameplay may end up lacking with our discussion about not needing or wanting to settle on the coast for a variety of reasons from last episode, of course. This only widened the scope of his reservations. As is the case for now, it is still too early to tell exactly how things will pan out. However, in his experience, it happens too frequently in video games where the water aspect usually ends up being at best a less fleshed out experience and at worst an afterthought. Just hopes that Fraxis has included some incentive to be coastal as it is notable aspect in a number of civilizations. I think on that point, probably last episode, I mean, we talked a lot about, okay, don't bother settling on the coast because you can put a harbor there and do everything that way. But when it comes to adjacencies, possibly, there's incentive for being coastal. Also, maybe you drop yourself on the coast because you can get extra resources and stuff, which we kind of talked about, but maybe you don't need the harbor right away. And then you'd probably want your city on the coast as well. But with adjacencies, especially for, say, Japan, it sort of feels like you do want your city center on the coast so that you can put your harbor right next to it. Then a couple other districts right next to the harbor and then get a boosted harbor.
Have you noticed the coast may be the only place where you can get a desert? You'll have that one hex that's actually a desert where everything else is not.
Well, hopefully they don't do that. Also, Fight Mars is also increasingly interested in what's going on with the religious system. He's mostly curious as to what pantheons are going to be, what their general power level is going to be. Though it's probably very premature, obviously. And slightly less urgent of a question is what their scope is going to be. Will religion have more weight in terms of mechanics, or will it be mostly bonuses? With the lack of World Congress, motion for world religion aren't going to be a thing, unless they've added other mechanics to fill that gap of inter- and intra-religion interactions. Well, I don't think they've really talked about religions yet. I mean, on a grand scale.
Yes.
Grand scale, they really haven't talked about a lot of stuff that would even tie into religion. Like, is there text for religions? Is there civics? Other than, you know, go build holy site, get faith. Other than that, how does religion interact with your empire? Is there going to be a religious social policy slot? Maybe a theocracy as a government type? And then add in some religious policies that help you destroy everybody else who's not for religion?
We shall see. You know there's a religious district, at the very least,
yes,
where you can build temples and stuff like that.
Well, yeah, but that's kind of required for just having religion. It's just a question of how... I mean, religion is going to be in the game, unlike in Civ 5, but at what level of state will it be? If it's just the Civ 5-ish style of, okay, you get some bonuses, and it doesn't really matter for the rest of it, other than getting your bonuses to give you more. It could be that low, or it could be something else.
I wonder if it's going to be adaptive, like tech is going to be, and that the choices that you make sort of influence which way your religion is going.
I think it'd be kind of cool if you could have schisms and protesters. So you might have founded the religion, but then you spread it to another civ, and then they go, yeah, we don't like you anymore, so we're going to keep the religion, except that we're going to change the founder belief to be our founder belief, and we'll have a schism. So we'll both believe in, you know, Kaugomu. They'll both believe in the generalized, and therefore both hate other people from other religions or whatever, but they'll have a break between them because they don't like each other anymore. That'd be kind of cool if they added that sort of level of stuff.
Or Dan will spread Condorism to somebody and they'll turn it into reverse Condorism.
Exactly. We need reverse Condorism to exist.
Man, then we really can cleanse the heresy.
Or instead of the
monster,
they have the flying pasta monster. We do not believe that the shape of the pasta is any way constrained to just spaghetti. It can be of all kinds of pasta. Macaroni.
Bow tie. Anything other than bow tie is wrong. Get wrecked, not bow ties.
So otherwise, on the other feedback-ish, Marshmallow Bear was talking about, we repeatedly are thinking that it's an or situation with policies, forgetting the various governments have various combo slots. So you could be that guy who gets both colonization for the reduced settlers and the plus one production in city-state, or be the guy who gets the free envoys and influence points. Actually, I don't think you could do both, but whatever. I don't think that's an either-or, per se. Yes, I mean, if you get into, I'm guessing, a government that has the extra slots that you could slot in multiples, yes. But at some point, you do have to make a choice.
Being a slot, in general.
Yeah. You have to fill it with something.
Oh, dear.
Anyways, then Dan responded to a bunch of people, but he's not here to talk about that, so, oh well.
You wanted to respond to the comment about Beyond Earth being a good game, it just was never finished?
No.
Oh.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
I thought that comment was interesting, personally. Like, that's why people don't like it, because it wasn't finished. It currently isn't finished. If you can see that, then that's why people don't like it.
It's also badly designed. Really badly designed. So many things just don't work with each other.
It's like a mishmash of good and bad ideas that has no unison at all.
So Illiterist, is this one you're talking about? I wonder if you're in denial or if you have lost the hope long time ago. How can you talk about Civ 6 knowing it means Beyond Earth will never become a decent successor to Alpha Centauri, especially when E3 walkthrough forces Sean Bean to say, finally, we move forward to the next chapter of our destiny, while it's obvious he wants to say, move forward Beyond Earth, ha ha ha. Anyways, let's talk about District Tourism. He expects every war after mid-game to be literal Stalingrad. What about my immersion?
We'll see. Now, if you get a pile of pillage, how is it repaired? That is a good question.
Yeah, that's a fine question. Do you need a builder? Can you do it through your city menu?
Is it just a matter of time so that you're host for a little while? Could be like that, too.
Yep. Can districts just get pillaged out of existence?
Oh, jeez.
Oh, that's not my wonder district.
I don't know if having it actually be literal Stalingrad is a good idea.
It's like, bombers come in and, oops, no more district for you. You have to rebuild it from scratch.
It has become pretty obvious by now that Beyond Earth is damaged beyond repair. The initial trade route spam stuff where you had to do really heavy micromanagement to even have a semblance of optimized play. The balancing between techs and stealing science. The coups of capitals at first that got patched out. But
at first, that was ridiculous.
And just like the tech path you would wind up taking in general. The whole thing's a mess.
Let's face it, building something on the Civ 5 engine, Delgene War Games, is nothing but a cash cow.
Yeah.
The thing about Alpha Centauri was it didn't try to remake the wheel. It was basically Civ with a few new things, like the factions were a little bit different, you know. And they put in a lot more science fiction concepts, but at its core, it was just Civ, you know.
Yeah, but it also had more flavor added to it, I think.
Yeah, it's probably the most flavorful game in the series, I would guess.
Well, obviously, because it was, you know, not on Earth looking at historical stuff, they could add a lot of flavor to it.
Yeah, and, right, like the characters all had their backstories, and then the planet itself had a backstory, and yeah, there's a lot there.
Do-do-do-do-do, Barbs, something about where did the horses come from? When we were talking about Barbs needing horses for horse units, he had flashbacks to some MP games where everybody went to Tilla. Too many horse archers. Yeah. I would still prefer Barbs requiring a horse nearby to pop up horse archers.
I want to see Barbs function like city states, not just spawning from nothing and telefragging you, but that's just personal preference.
And Telkov mentions, even though we're disappointed with Beyond Earth and Bert, we still sort of need that last expansion to get Ernie. But only if they call it Ernie. If they call it anything other than Ernie, just stop. Go away.
Ernie is the only solution.
Yep.
Yeah.
In the forums, once a king, Mike supposes it's too early to think about detailed ideas and strategy.
Yes.
You know, especially with yields and turn time, blah, blah, blah. I would say we definitely don't know enough about Civ 6 to worry about strategy yet. Strategy isn't something that is new. What do I build first?
The chances that they're not going to take a couple pieces of information and say, this is what we can do with it.
Yeah. People are definitely going to go out on a limb here. Every little detail that they see from now until it's released.
Sometimes it might actually be correct, too.
Yeah, if you throw enough darts, some of them hit.
Yeah.
The problem is we don't have the numbers yet.
Yeah,
or at least we don't have all the numbers we need to make even an estimation of what like your best first build would be. You could say whatever you want, but nobody, and I mean nobody, knows what it's going to be the best build on release.
And let's face it. A good strategy game doesn't have a right order all the time. You know,
if you
can't make different choices, then it's not a good game.
That's true.
But there should be some strategy plans. And he did use an S on the end of plan. So once the king was mentioning that there could be multiples.
Yeah, and there should be, and there probably will be. If you don't have the numeric details, it becomes really difficult to evaluate one choice against another. And if you can't do that, then why would you pick one at this stage? It's silly. Yeah.
Well, I mean, some of the first questions are like the right off the mark. What you know, you slap down your city. What do you build first?
I usually prefer to build a scout right away, just because knowledge is power. But I'm sure you're going to get lots of people who are going to try these builders out right away, right? So hard to say.
Worker first in Civ 5 was not really optimal.
Yeah, it's been since Civ 4 since worker first was optimal.
And
Civ 4, it was in most cases, not all cases though. Granted. But in most cases, Orca First was dominant in Civ 4, and Scout in 5.
Yeah, so it's a question of Scout first, Warrior, Slinger. Probably not a unit first, other than maybe a Scout. Unless you've got Barbs staring at you on turn 1, I don't think a Warrior or a Slinger would be that useful.
Or they just start you with 2 Scouts or something, so everyone has them. Then you wouldn't build one, but we don't know that yet.
And even that depends on the map size and the settings, too. If you know you're going to be in a cramped map, you may want to build some military units first. But,
yeah, if you're an archipelago, a scout first is a little iffy, isn't it?
Yes.
Woohoo! I saw the only other tile on my island. Okay, that was worth it. Building first sort of just depends on what buildings are available right off the mark versus needing a tech, right?
Yeah. Is there anything even like a monument this go around? A monument might require tech now that you don't start with, which was not the case in Civ 5, but it could be in Civ 6. It was the case in Civ 4. You did not have access to monuments immediately unless you happened to start with mysticism. So,
exactly.
And you would never build one first in Civ 4 anyway, like ever.
In Civ 5 you would.
Yeah, in Civ 5 there would be some circumstances that would be the best move, but not in Civ 4, because it just gave you culture, and you already had culture from your palace, and it would have been absurd.
Well, in Civ 6, civics are a completely other tree. They're far more important, which means culture is more important. How fast does it take you to get to the policy that lets you build settlers in half time?
Yeah, and how valuable is that? Again, the devil's in the details here.
Well, yes, that's definitely devil in the details. If it cuts down your turn time by like 1 or 2 because settlers are super cheap to begin with, then yeah, not so much. But
or if you have something that's similarly valuable to the settlers or more so you would only pick that if you have a lot of open territory. Otherwise, you'd prefer something that makes your current cities better and you just conquer cities. Then that kind of setup could be too.
Yeah, but people are already talking about rapid expansion, so there's got to be some benefit to it.
Yeah, well, there was a ton of benefit to rapid expansion vanilla Civ 5 release, too.
Oh, yeah.
Some people were talking about early great people as the anti-expansion benefit. So instead of building settlers, you slap down a district and work the district to get a great person faster. Since it's communal great people, it's not individual.
Does your great person cost go up as you get larger?
I don't know. But it's a global pool, so everybody
gets been to some degree in every Civ that I've played.
No, but Civ 5, it wasn't global. If you got a great scientist that didn't change
else's. You meant that way. I meant within the Civ. Yeah, so you would rush it out so you could get them while other people can't. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, but again, even on that one, since we don't know what they do, if they're personalized or if they have special abilities that could be good or could be meh. Yeah, even on that, you have to kind of know if the first one or two are really, really good. Then maybe you want to push for that rather than push for another city location.
You could turn that into an all-in rush if they're not careful. Because if you go like quad science with a settled scientist early on or something, you can have someone pushing out more advanced unit techs too much faster than anyone to just go settlers.
Yeah.
I could picture that being the case.
So it kind of just depends on what those great people do. The other option, somebody goes for mass settlers, you go horse units, and you attack, and maybe you can't afford to actually take their cities, but you can keep them from getting luxuries or whatever else happiness-related stuff might exist.
You can basically lock them out of improvements outright, at least in Civ 5 you can, and you probably can in 6 as well.
Yeah, so if that's the case and all they did was expand, eventually people get unhappy.
Well, they just can't build anything useful in a useful amount of time, and they're suppressed by, like, 2 horses.
Yeah, and they need to burn everything down. I guess the other question is, what district would you build first? Holy site for the religion, military for the barbs, science for the tech. Obviously, Bill's going to say, well, it depends because we don't know, blah, blah, blah. So it's a question of, let's assume you have option on religion early, and you have an option on a district that will give you really, really good bonuses. Which do you do, especially if they're separate? Or do you bother with a district early? Do you delay your district, or do you go for it?
This time you would take the bonuses, I would hope, because it's like strong but situational, right? So normally that's tuned so that it's a higher yield, and if it isn't, well, screw it then.
Well,
but the only real answer here is you just build military and go kill all the other things. Well, and by barbarians, we mean other civilizations, because we're in like the Romans.
True. That's always a limitation on expansion, is your smart neighbors who don't want you to expand.
Yep. Yeah, the AI's not so good at that, though. At least historically, that's been a strictly MP consideration, and only competitive MP at that. Yep. Or maybe a little bit of ish in turn cast. Well,
a little bit of ish.
Maybe Ed Veach has done better with the AI this time.
Maybe. So. It would be difficult, though, because if you make it super aggressive, then you're just going to wind up with early game wars all the time over land. Including between AIs, unless you have it biased against the player. And if you don't have it biased against the player or do that, then players are going to win the city rush duels, basically. Or unit block them, or... That's really difficult to do with what the bounds of current AI is.
Yeah.
I would say it's not fair to expect a really strong AI there. If they have a really strong AI there, I'd be surprised. And I'd be very pleasantly surprised. Like, that would be major improvement. To gaming in general.
If they can make the Civ 6 AI act more like the Civ 4 AI, where Civ 4 AI was actually more competitive on Prince or whatever Civ 4 level was, the default no bonus level.
I think it was Prince, yeah.
Yeah, well, versus double. Civ 5's Prince level is still like a punching bag.
I feel like Civ 4's noble is also a punching bag.
Well, yeah, but... It's less so, especially as you rise up towards deity. I'm just saying, as compared to Civ 5.
That's true.
Where you get up to Emperor level on Civ 5 and still use the AI as a punching bag.
That's true. It gets a little harder in Civ 4, but that's almost entirely related to stacking.
Yeah, but the AI was able to use the game in Civ 4 better than in Civ 5.
To be honest, I think Soren Johnson did a pretty good, decent job with the programming tools available in Civ 4 of doing the AI there, as opposed to Civ 5, which I think it could have been a lot better.
I mostly agree. However, I disagree with the fundamental premise Soren used for AI versus Civ 5 AI. I know I'm not necessarily a majority opinion, but I prefer the AI to act like another player that's trying to win the game, rather than being some sort of role-play tool bag that doesn't actually play the game. It plays some other game that has different roles than the game the player is playing.
Yeah, that doesn't play to win.
I agree with you. AI to play to win. And while the Civ AI 5 AI isn't great, it tries more than the Civ 4 AI tried.
Yeah, I would still prefer that.
The Emperor level AI is a punching bag, and that's making me feel awfully, awfully inadequate.
It's okay. I get nasty comments all the time from people who play at Prince level.
If you want to like really wreck the AI though, like you could, I honestly just pick Pangaea and build like horse archers as the Huns, and you can win on deity with that. Especially if you play on a slower speed to make it easier on yourself. If we're talking Emperor, you could do that with chariots. If you have horse, of course.
Of course.
If you're willing to multi-front war and micromanage a little bit, you can literally win the map that way on Emperor. Pick India and spam elephant archers. You win.
You're making me hope that in Civ 6 they bring back AI cheating with a vengeance. That's all I'm thinking right now.
Yeah. Well, there's bonuses on AI, like, if that's what you mean by cheating. It never cheated in any other way other than receiving massive amounts of extra resources or lower unit costs or whatever.
Yeah, we never want it to cheat on mechanics.
Now, the Civ 4 deity bonuses were asinine. Less than half unit cost starts with an extra settler like Civ 5. Less than half tech costs, like, they were crazy. But even then, it wouldn't have mattered if it was one unit per tile. Because of the stacking is what made them so threatening.
Yep. You're making me wonder why now Civilization isn't an e-sport now. There's people who say, oh yeah, godlike, I can beat that, just do this. Just
because it's not competitively tuned. You can spawn lose. I could beat the best players in the world in Civ 4 if I pick Mali and they don't start with a resource in their capital and we're near each other. Because I just build two skirmishers, walk over there, pillage them, and stand there. They can't do anything. There's no counterplay at all.
No, like, it's not that. Crap. It's not that, because you can use maps to change. You can use strategic maps. But it's not that. It's the turn times.
Oh, yeah. That's true.
That's what stops it from being an esport. Because if it takes 10 hours to play a game, no one's going to watch that.
Yeah. Not live, anyway. You would have to do heavily edited.
You'd have to do a highlights version.
Yeah.
But people can relate to it so much more. I mean, they'd say, so America got the pyramids, and that enabled them to do that.
It's interesting, though, because like in multiplayer, you see things come up that you wouldn't even consider in single player. Science victory video.
The purpose of this show is to educate you on our research process, as well as to get our science advisor to maybe shut up for 1 minute.
It's only like a 4 minute video. The creator is here, White Lightning HQ. It's kind of amusing.
I decided to explore some concepts that have been largely ignored for hundreds of years, and this is what I came up with. I call it a pot.
Wow, that seems really obvious, actually. Why have we not come up with that yet?
I don't know.
Basically, two guys talking about science discoveries in Civ 5.
We discover things out of order all the time here at the research lab, but we don't know why.
No, don't tell them that. It's just one of those mysteries of science.
And a third guy who acts like a spy steals their tech.
Yeah.
Where's all of our stuff? Hey, Scout? Are you a spy?
No.
That brings up the hope that the Civ 6 tech tree and or civic tree actually makes a little bit more sense in its pathing.
Hey, wait. Where'd the internet go?
How would that even work?
It didn't. It felt like something was missing. Like it needed some kind of high-level computation device.
Support the ongoing Polycast Patreon campaign.
Collective achievements.
Personal incentives.
Month-to-month commitment.
For more information, visit thepolycast.net/Patreon.
Call in today.
In North America, 301-637-7659.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
Log on to the series' official website at
thepolycast.net.
Tricky thing with Civ is that they're always going for play balance with radically different civilizations that each have their own effect. and you really don't know what the effect is until you have a couple hundred thousand players playing it once and saying, wait a minute, I found an exploit.
Yeah, and the difference between game mechanic and an exploit can be pretty gray at times, to be honest.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's not necessarily an exploit that they found, but they found that it was just, this kind of breaks things. Like, it's in there and it's a game mechanic, but if you use it these ways...
it's imbalanced.
I mean, practice is usually pretty good at follow-on patches. Just look at Civ
5. And one person's game mechanic is another person's exploit sometimes, too.
I disrespect the term exploit when used as a derogatory term against in-game tactics outright. I'm sorry, I do.
Yeah.
No negative connotation. It's just what it is. You know, I want to call it min-maxing, go right ahead.
Or
well, that's fine, but then min-maxing is definitely, like, with intentional design. You know, when I think of something that's an exploit, I'm thinking of something that's abusing a bug to gain an advantage. That's what strikes me as one.
I've seen in the past, writes me an email and says, there's no way this player could have this many chariots by this X time. And all it is expert micromanaging.
I would believe you.
Well, do you remember Civ 1? People were making 100 million population cities, you know?
Yeah, you sit there and you have enough time and patience to micromanage the heck out of it, you can do it.
Yeah, but that's different than exploit.
It's not exploiting a bug, it's exploiting game design, but it's still an exploit.
Yeah, no. I think it's slightly different. Just that's more of an imbalanced or badly tuned.
You call it an exploit multiplayer game.
No, using something imbalanced in multiplayer is not an exploit.
No. It just means that design has to be adjusted. Exploit is more when multiple mechanics come together and you find something that really breaks the game because that's not really what either mechanic was meant to do, but when you slap them together, you find something different.
That's also imbalance.
If anyone's going to find an exploit or a balance in the game, MP players will definitely do that.
We're teaching people the meaning of exploit.
Yeah.
Rather that, it's so argued over that there's barely any.
Okay, how about this? There will be oddities in the game, and people will find them, and then Firaxis will fix them within 30 days.
Yeah.
All you have to do is look at Civ 5's mass volume of patches to know that they're willing to do it.
Hope you enjoyed this episode of the Polycast.
Thanks, everyone, for letting me in on this exclusive group, and hopefully Dan will let me back again soon.
Absolutely. It's good having you.
Maybe as we get closer to the game, there'll be some actual MP details, and I can come back to discuss them.
Hopefully.
We hope.
They at least acknowledged MP this time.
Yeah, let's hope MP works when they release the game this go-around.
Knock on wood, knock on silver, knock on all the things.
I'm Jonah Falcon. I'm saying goodbye. And all the rest of you just say goodbye as well.
Bye as well.
Goodbye as well by the Mint team.
Bye-bye.
Later.
I'm professional, really. I'm good at this. I've done Polycast before, can you tell?
We've been at this for years. So much XP.
Because I'm just thinking about future scenarios. You know they're going to have...
Apparently they got beeped.
That might have been me. I don't know.
Yes.
Maybe.
Because if they're going to call it out in a Civ specific, and you just got bleeped again.
Auto-sensor.
We don't know what Germany has, or if there exist.
They have the Porsche, don't they? Oh, never mind.
Yeah.
That would be nice, but no.
Yeah.
Knock on silicone, really?
Knock on silicone?
Silicon.
Let's continue.
I love how you guys really go to boobs.
I said nothing of that nature, Mackie.
Seriously, that had nothing to do with boobs. You're the only one who brought up boobs.
You brought up silicone.
Boobs are not made out of silicone.
Not real ones.
Mackie, what do you want to do? Do you want a religion? Do you want barbs? Or do you want science?
She wants barbs. Who doesn't want barbs?
Did Mackie walk away?
Although feel free to answer for yourself, Mackie.
She muted herself, didn't she?
Well, then I'll answer for her. She wants barbs. Okay.
Record date July 9th, 2016. Civilization 6 Clips, copyright 2K Games. Civ 5 Science Victory Clips, copyright White Lightning. Civilization 4, 5, and Beyond Earth Sound Clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.